They lure them, and they take them to Anchorage, and they take them elsewhere, and we never see them come back.
Lawmakers prepare to consider strengthening the sex trafficking laws. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a progress report on oil spill safety after the Deepwater Horizon spill.
It's been disappointing to see the lack of action by Congress on things that only Congress can do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes that all students should be proficient in reading, writing, and math by the time they finish the third grade. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
The Parnell administration has waged a fight against sexual abuse and domestic violence in Alaska. The governor's bill, HB 359, making human trafficking a serious felony offense, failed to pass during the regular session, but the governor has made it a special session priority. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Lawmakers want tougher penalties for human trafficking. House Bill 359, which passed the House last week 37-0, makes sex trafficking in the first degree and human trafficking in the first degree felony offenses. The bill did not make it out of the Senate before the close of legislative business in the early hours of Monday morning, so Governor Sean Parnell has made it part of his special session agenda. On Monday, Parnell answered reporters' questions as to why the bill is on the agenda.
The testimony that was had in the committees is so compelling, and it's an issue that I think we have broad agreement in this legislature on, and we ought to just get that done this week.
Parnell said statistics show that even in our largest cities, shelters see victims of sex trafficking every single day. More disturbing, runaways can become trafficking victims within 48 hours. He says sex trafficking and human trafficking is modern-day slavery.
There are many circumstances that put a young girl or boy in that situation. And when you hear from the FBI and local law enforcement about how girls are sent out from Anchorage into the villages to recruit, and they're offered cosmetics, shelter, makeup, and it's a chance out of a really bad situation in their own home, they're going to take it, and they wind up in Anchorage, and they wind up being slaves.
Committee substitute for House Bill 359, Finance, amended and titled an act relating to conspiracy to commit human trafficking.
Last week, the House passed HB 359 as amended with little discussion. Representative Anna Faircloth says the bill changes the language used in the law so that the crime is no longer referred to as promoting prostitution, but as sex trafficking. She said the bill makes it harder for predators soliciting young people into prostitution by raising the age of a victim of prostitution from 18 to 20 years old, and creates tougher penalties for adult patrons of child prostitution.
This is saying if someone engages a prostitute that they believe to be under the age of 20 now, they are going to have a harsher penalty. It is a way for us to make safer people who may not know that predators are out to put them in a position that they don't want to be. It's a way to keep children and youth safe in our community.
Representative Bob Herron told the House that the Federal Bureau of Investigation came to his area in Bethel in 2010 to discuss sex crimes.
What stunned everyone was that the FBI and ATF reported to us that there was a particular interest in targeting young Yupik women from the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. The Wade Hampton district and parts of the Bethel Census district are considered the poorest in the nation. And so these young women, young girls, are easy prey for unscrupulous, evil people. They lure them, and they take them to Anchorage, and they take them elsewhere, and we never see them come back.
On Monday of this week, Parnell urged the legislature to pass HB 359 on the first day of the special session.
Is the bill going to stop that? It might stop it for some. And that's the hope. So this is clearly an issue in Anchorage, likely an issue in Fairbanks as well, and it clearly impacts our smaller rural communities.
Lawmakers will convene tomorrow for a special session of the 27th Alaska Legislature to address the human trafficking bill, oil tax reform, and legislation aimed at an interstate gas line. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska is playing a role in the growing field of unmanned aviation, and provisions in a recently passed Federal Aviation Administration Reauthorization Act could expand it. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The FAA reauthorization includes establishment of 6 national unmanned aerial vehicle test centers, as well as Arctic airspace for UAV research. The University of Alaska Fairbanks already runs an unmanned aircraft program, and manager Greg Walker says it's well-suited to take on areas of study targeted by the federal government.
Climate change concerns, you have natural resource exploitation in, you know, the Chukchi with the oil industry, for example, in the Beaufort Sea. You've got animals work we're doing in Aleutians.
Walker says there's no guarantee UAF will get FAA contracts, but its experience positions it well. UAF currently flies UAVs out of its Poker Flat rocket launch facility north of Fairbanks and is involved in federally funded research statewide. Walker, who recently returned from a marine mammal count in the Aleutian Islands, says UAVs are a great tool in Alaska.
There are more applications in Alaska, bona fide applications that justify the use of an unmanned aircraft than probably the lower 48 combined. There's places you don't want to put humans, you know, in volcanoes. You know, we were flying just last 3 weeks, so we just got off a ship in Dutch Harbor. We've been out all over the Aleutian Islands, through the entire Aleutian chain, looking for marine mammals, actually imaging stellar sea lions for counts and helping the surveys.
Walker says much of the focus is on government contracts, but the projects result in some private sector spinoff.
We've managed to help initiate a couple companies in Alaska that working with us have started up and actually are looking like they're going fairly strong. We've got some other companies from the lower 48 that are looking to locate a person up here to start an office, to start trying to figure out how to best to leverage the work we're doing. And we're not even, you know, formally a center yet with the FAA.
One of the Alaska companies that's benefited is Fairbanks-based Polartronics. Former UAF scientist Kevin Abnett's company makes tiny sensors, including models that can be mounted on UAVs.
I basically live in a cabin in the Goldstream Valley, and my shop is my garage. You know, you don't really need a lot of space to do, you know, R&D work, especially when the sensors you make are really small.
Abnett says he designs sensor circuit boards on his computer. Most are manufactured outside, but Abnett is working to bring that work to Fairbanks. He says Polartronics' current project is developing a UAV-mounted volcanic ash sensor for the Air Force.
Having a UAV fly through an ash cloud is a lot better than a manned aircraft for a number of reasons, mostly safety. So that's sort of our niche is that we can do some of the analysis right on board the UAV and telemeter the data back.
Another Alaska UAV business is Wasilla-based Airborne Technologies. Owner Tim Veenstra says he saw an opportunity while collaborating on a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration survey for abandoned high seas fishing nets.
The need for a small unmanned aircraft that could be launched from any vessel and operated in the marine environment.
Veenstra says the result is a marine surveillance aircraft called the Resolution.
It's a flying wing, roughly 8-foot wingspan, but in addition to the airframe, there's the ground control software, there's the anomaly detection software, there is the autopilot, which is huge, and then there's the sensor package that you're going to put into the airframe.
Veenstra says the Resolution shoebox-sized payload can carry still, video, and infrared cameras, or whatever a client wants. Airborne Technologies has collaborated on a proposal with UAF to assist in a NOAA survey of at-sea tsunami debris from last year's earthquake in Japan. Veenstra says his hope is that the project and others will lead to enough demand that his company can manufacture UAVs in Alaska. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A bill that passed the legislature will benefit businesses that operate around military installations. Businesses inside state-designated military facility zones would have access to tax breaks and low-interest loans. Sponsor Representative Steve Thompson of Fairbanks says the change could attract new companies to meet specific military needs in Alaska. As an example, Thompson says there's opportunity around Eielson Air Force Base related to unmanned aerial vehicles.
Grumman or Lockheed or whoever is making them decided that, you know, the Air Force is going to be doing their training and a lot of their work with those up at Eielson, they might want to build out by Eielson a repair facility, a place where they take and resupply parts and things. They could have federal tax credits. They could get low-interest loans through the state or through the feds. There's a lot of things that can happen.
The legislature appropriated $5 million to the University of Alaska Fairbanks to collaborate with the Federal Aviation Administration on a UAV research and development program and a possible FAA National Test Center. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, school districts are grateful for legislative funding with some reservations.
Did we get everything we wanted? No. Did we get it the way we wanted? No. Did we get it when we wanted? No.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The former members of the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission aren't handing out any A's as they grade the progress industry, Congress, and the Interior Department have made since the accident 2 years ago. In a new report, the members reserve their harshest criticism for Congress, which they say hasn't done enough to make offshore oil drilling safer. Former Lieutenant Governor Fran Ulmer was a member of the commission. She says it's not all bad news. Some good changes have been made.
Just as a couple of examples, the Department of Interior had something called the Minerals Management Service, and that got completely jettisoned, reorganized, broken into pieces that were more appropriate in terms of their functions. One of our recommendations was to do that so that there would be not only better focus and clarity, accountability, but also so that the various agency people could work with industry to evolve the kind of safety improvements that have been accomplished in other countries like Norway. So the industry, too, has taken up the challenge. They have created a separate safety institute that really focuses on best practices. They've created the marine containment approach to dealing with a large spill in the Gulf of Mexico. There are two different systems in place now that didn't exist before the Deepwater Horizon disaster. So a number of things, and a lot of those things are still ongoing. The work isn't finished by any means, but progress has been made.
And what are the biggest areas where industry, Congress, or the administration has fallen short?
Well, there are a lot of things that are in progress, so it's a little soon to call them failures in the sense that we really see a lot of activity ongoing. And our plan as a commission is to do an annual report card so that we can continue to monitor progress on the things that we feel are really, really important. A good example of that as it relates to the agencies, for example, we know that the Coast Guard needs additional resources to be able to effectively respond if there's an incident in the Arctic. They are doing what they can with what they've got to prepare for next summer's exploratory drilling that Shell is planning to do, but they are moving assets that really need to be kept where they used to exist and aren't necessarily as well suited for the Arctic conditions as what's necessary. So the kind of investment that needs to be made by Congress to really scale up the ability of the Coast Guard to respond not just to an oil incident, but to any kind of a shipping or navigational problem, a tourism disaster. So that is a big to-do for Congress, for the Coast Guard, and that unquestionably takes time. You can't do it overnight, but it's past due by way of a commitment of this country to really be prepared for Arctic development.
In the report, you give Congress the worst grade, a D. Why is that?
It's been disappointing to see the lack of action by Congress on things that only Congress can do. So, some examples. Increasing the liability limit. $75 million was set as the incident limit back 20 years ago in the Oil Pollution Act that passed after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It has not been increased since. $75 million doesn't get you very far in terms of dealing with a disaster. Thank goodness that BP ignored that limit and basically invested billions of dollars in the response effort and in compensating victims. That limit needs to be increased. Only Congress can do that. There have been bills introduced to do it, but no action. Similarly, only Congress can appropriate the funds necessary, whether it's for oil spill pollution research, which is needed, for assuring that the agencies have the kind of personnel needed for the expertise to be able to do the safety regulation that is an important piece of a safer operation in our country, or the Coast Guard investments that we've talked about. So when you look across the board of the things that were recommended not only by our commission, but by the people who live in the Gulf of Mexico region, the industry, others that have recommended action by Congress, it just hasn't happened yet. I don't give up hope that it will, but so far we couldn't justify a grade higher than D.
Fran Ulmer is chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and a former member of the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission. She is speaking about the new report in a presentation at the University of Alaska Anchorage bookstore tomorrow at 5 p.m. Links to the full report are at our website, alaskapublic.org. In a last-minute push, the Alaska legislature passed funding for schools over the weekend. They passed SB 182, an education package, and SB 160, the capital budget. Together, they provide more than $100 million in funding for districts across the state. KSKA's Daisha Eaton explains.
The legislature passed what they're calling an omnibus bill that provides one-time funding for specific education projects, plus the capital budget, which includes some education funding. In total, the bills provide about $111 million for programs from busing to vocational education, plus relieve local communities of some of their funding obligations. That's something Carl Rose, the executive director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, says he's mostly pleased about.
That is a significant investment that late in the session, and I was extremely pleased. Did we get everything we wanted? No. Did we get it the way we wanted? No. Did we get it when we wanted? No.
Rose says he would have preferred an increase to the base student allocation, the per pupil rate of $5,680 used in a complex funding formula, something his organization has been pushing for. The BSA is recurring money that can be used flexibly by districts. Rose says the big worry is that the funding the legislature approved does not give districts the opportunity to build their budgets into the future.
The biggest concern I have is we can't depend on these monies on a regular basis because they were outside the foundation formula, the base student allocation.
But Carol Como, the superintendent for the state's largest district in Anchorage, says she'll take what she can get, and the funding translates into some helpful increases for her district.
One of the things that we're very excited about they did was increase pupil transportation funding for this school year to help us with costs already and then going forward. Another exciting thing they did was increase the voc ed career and technical education factor by about 50%. And then apparently they put some money outside the formula, one-time cost, whatever our amount is, we'll be able to use it flexibly, as I understand it.
Como says if her district is creative, she's hopeful the new funding will allow them to reinstate some cuts made back in January. But Barb Angayak, the president of the National Education Association of Alaska, is doubtful because most of the money comes allocated for specific projects.
The allocations that came out of the legislature this year, some of the funding is very specific. For example, pupil transportation is money that is allocated for that specific purpose. The career tech, we are very appreciative of the money, but it can only be allocated for those type of programs.
Angayak says the new funding does not address some core problems districts are dealing with, and there will be larger class sizes and teacher and program cuts in many districts across the state. How those cuts are made over the next few months, Angayak says, is something parents should be paying attention to.
And if parents and community members are concerned about that, they ought to be focused on making sure that the districts are taking a very, very careful look at where cuts are going to be made to be sure that the programs and the direct impact to students is minimum.
The governor has 20 days from when the bills land on his desk to make changes. He could still use his line item veto power. The money will likely be delivered to districts and budgets finalized sometime this June. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
A proposed federal rule for managing America's polar bears will look a lot like previous policy that did not address the effects of greenhouse gases on sea ice. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced today the polar bear proposal will not change management and conservation efforts. Polar bears were listed as threatened in 2008 because of losses to sea ice habitat. Former Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne said the Endangered Species Act would not be used to limit greenhouse gases blamed for Arctic warming. Brendan Cummings of the Center for Biological Diversity says President Obama is duplicating the ineffective measures of his predecessor. He says polar bear conservation measures that don't mention greenhouse gases are like discussing the Titanic without mentioning icebergs. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will prepare a recovery plan for the North Pacific right whale, according to a notice published today in the Federal Register. The Center for Biological Diversity last month gave 60-day notice that it intended to sue over the agency's failure to update its recovery plan for the highly endangered whale. Spokeswoman Rebecca Noblin says only a few dozen remain, and they need the full protection of the Endangered Species Act. There may have been as many as 20,000 right whales in the early 1800s, but whalers decimated them. The survivors most years can be found in the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea during summer feeding months. NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service also will update a recovery plan for endangered blue whales. Last month, Alaska-based Penn Air landed the country's most expensive essential air service contract for a flight from Presque Isle, Maine to Boston. Now Penn Air is on track to receive the second most expensive EAS subsidiary in the nation as well for flight service between Anchorage and Adak. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
If there were ever a place where air service is essential, it's Adak. All of the town's groceries, mail, and freight come in via plane. For the last decade, Alaska Airlines has flown a Boeing 737 combi plane out to Adak twice a week. The plane can hold 72 passengers and enough cargo to keep the community of 300 people well-stocked. In exchange for the service, Alaska Airlines receives a $1.6 million annual subsidy from the Department of Transportation as part of the Essential Air Service, or EAS, program. That program compensates airlines for flying routes that would otherwise be unprofitable. But in February, Alaska Airlines announced it wouldn't be bidding on ADAC's EAS subsidy this year. Company spokesperson Scott Haberstad says rising fuel costs and decreasing revenues would have required a substantial increase in the airline's bid, which it didn't think the DOT would accept. Except it turns out that evaluation might have been premature. Only one airline ended up bidding on the route, and it's asking for double what Alaska Airlines was being paid. Penn Air is proposing to purchase a 30-seat Saab turboprop and fly it out to ADAC 4 times a week in exchange for a $3.4 million subsidy. In addition to being double Alaska's rate, that's 3 times what the airline bid the last time they went through the EAS process for ADAC. Penn Air President Scott Blomquist says it's a good thing they weren't awarded the contract last time.
Overall, on all revenue, with passenger revenues and freight revenues and mail revenues, we projected a pretty high number in 2 years ago when we bid it, and when comes out in the end, those revenues weren't there. Alaska bid it with a far less projection of revenues than we did, and they were much closer in their bid 2 years ago than what we were.
Penn Air's revenue projection this time around is about $300,000 less than Alaska Airlines in 2010 and $2.4 million less than its own 2010 proposal. DOT is reviewing the numbers, but Blomquist says he's confident they'll come to the conclusion that his passenger revenue calculations are correct.
Everything we've gone through so far, they've had to agree with, and the only question is the revenue. They had a higher revenue number, and we had a conversation with them yesterday, and they're going to go back and look at where they got theirs from. And we're going to look at where we got ours from and compare them once again. If the revenue number is higher, I adjust it then.
Blomquist pegged net revenue per round-trip passenger at $786 in the proposal. Tickets to ADAC on Alaska Airlines run between $1,200 and $1,500 at the moment, including taxes and fees. Blomquist says even if he's off in his numbers, though, the difference won't change the fundamental economics of the situation. So long as the market in ADAC isn't growing and fuel costs continue to rise, the need for a subsidy will continue to grow. He says ultimately, if DOT thinks the proposal is too much, then they'll have to decide what level of service is necessary in ADAC.
I think DOT has to look at it very closely and see what they can live with in the EAS market. They know there's going to be increases just because of fuel alone.
DOT spokesperson Bill Moseley said he couldn't talk about the proposal while it's still open for public comment, but did say the department reserves the right to negotiate or reject a bid that doesn't meet the community's needs. And ADAC, for its part, hasn't weighed in yet. City Manager Leighton Lockett says a public meeting about the issue drew a crowd, but he isn't willing to comment further until he's had a chance to speak with Penn Air. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.